Welcome to Literary Arts, the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers over the first 30 years of literary arts in Portland. This time, Calvin Trillin. He's one of our favorite writers here at Literary Arts. Trillin was our very first speaker when Portland Arts and Lectures was just getting started in 1984. Coming up, it's Trillin's talk from 1989. He's got a pretty hilarious take on American politics, and much of it still holds true today. Over his illustrious, award-winning career, he has written for The New Yorker, Time, and The Nation, among other notable publications, and is now known as one of the most significant American political satirists of the last 50 years. Let's get right to it. It's Calvin Trillin on Literary Arts, The Archive Project.
Thank you. I'm sorry I'm not going to have an opportunity to demonstrate my parallel parking tonight. I speak as the ex-co-editor of a magazine called Beautiful Spot, a magazine of parking. And it's our first issue came out something like 22 years ago, and we recently had a celebration of that, a celebration that was hardly dampened at all by the fact that our second issue has not come out. Had production difficulties. I'm very happy to be in Portland in the Pacific Northwest. It's everybody's favorite region. I actually have a great interest in American regions, and I suppose to the extent that I'm talking about anything, that's what I'll be talking about. Geography was my best subject. I know it's not fashionable to say that now. You can imagine how distressed I am when I read these studies that show that the average American high school student tends to identify Alabama as the capital of Chicago. I could name all the state capitals. I could name major mineral resources. Missouri, lead and zinc. I knew so many geographical facts that I've been trying to forget some of them, so I'll have room in my mind for some things that I consider more important. I don't hold with the theory that everybody's just using a tiny bit of his gray matter. I think we're all going flat out. In fact, I was here last spring, and I heard about a wonderful award at the that's awarded at the graduation of the Oregon Episcopal School. It's called the Fano Creek Fun with Phonics Award. It's for the most creative speller in the class. And it reminded me that when I was in high school, for some high school club, I was made to learn the longest word in the English language and also how to spell it, pneumono-ultramicroscopic silico-volcano-coniosis. It was then the longest word in the English language. They probably have longer words now. I don't find it a very useful piece of knowledge. There are only so many times you can say, speaking of diseases contracted through the inhalation of quartz dust. So I've been trying to forget it. I finally managed to forget how to spell it, and I was able to remember my Army serial number. This was several years after I left the Army, but at least it showed that the theory is workable. I actually had suggested at one point that President Reagan might give this a try. I thought if he could forget the plots to some of those old Dana Andrews movies, he might be able to remember names of cabinet secretaries, something like that. Actually, in my geography, I'm interested in regions, but I don't divide the country up the way most of the regionalists do. I only have two regions. This is partly because of my math. It's hard for me to keep track of 10 or 12 regions. I was not good in math. I was never able to persuade my mathematics teacher that many of my answers were meant ironically. And I had trouble with pi, the kind of pi r squared sort of pi. Several years ago, and this is absolutely true, the Texas State Legislature passed a resolution in favor of changing pi to an even 3. And I was for it, too. The way I divide up the country is in two regions. One of them is the part of the country that had Major League Baseball before the Second World War. That's called the Ancien United States. And the rest of the country is the rest of the country. That's called the Expansion Team United States. If you're not absolutely conversant with baseball as it stood in 1945, you may need some help in identifying which part of the United States is which. It's fairly easy to tell. I myself am from the Expansion Team United States, from Kansas City, and I now live in the Ancien United States. In the Ancien United States, the old country. If you're in an Italian restaurant, the waiter's likely to have a name like Sal or Vinny, something like that. If you're in an Italian restaurant and the waiter's name is Dwayne, you're in the Expansion Team, United States. I recognize the regions of my colleagues, of course, particularly the Midwest, my own region. As some of you who are interested in geography might know, most people identify the Midwest as the most American of regions. That means that somebody who comes from the Midwest is a typical American or a true American, or what is called in New York an out-of-towner. I don't want to make a big deal out of this. Midwesterners don't like to make a big deal out of anything, really. I realized that several years ago when I got interested in license plate mottos, various license plates in this country, and I realized that the eastern state had grandiose mottos. New York, the Empire State. Little New Hampshire, live free or die. That's their motto on the license plate. Pennsylvania used to have a great motto, the Keystone State. When you saw that motto, you could envision those great monuments in Philadelphia made out of pure Keystone, and great forges of Pittsburgh turning out one Keystone after another. And in the Amish farm country, fields of Keystones rippling in the breeze. Midwestern motto is much more modest. A few years ago, some people in Wisconsin expressed dissatisfaction with the license plate motto and an effort to change it. They were people who didn't feel they were adequately described by the motto, America's Dairyland. Somebody suggested, eat cheese or die. A lot of Midwestern states don't even have mottos on their license plates. This is pure modesty. I've made up some. Nebraska, a long way across. The one I made up for Arkansas, I think, is a bit wordy to fit on the plate. Now, I think of it kind of as a draft that needs cutting down. Arkansas, not as bad as you might have imagined. still, the Midwest is the place where the American vision is in people's minds. People, when people think of America, they have a Midwestern vision. They think of mom in the kitchen baking bread. And my own mother, I'd like to say, for 30 years, served her family nothing but leftovers. It wasn't until I got out of college that I began to think, leftover from what? We got a team of anthropologists there now looking for the original meal. Great fields of wheat, corn, and soybeans stretching out with great storage silos on the horizon. Kiwanis Club meeting on Wednesday for lunch. Chicken a la king. Well, it used to be chicken a la king. I've made a study of this, as some of you know, and I found that the chicken a la king has disappeared. This country used to be awash in chicken a la king. As a reporter, I visited a lot of Kiwanis luncheons, so many that I actually know all of the words to the Kiwanis song. I'd rather be a Kiwanian than in any other club. I had so much chicken a la king, I actually offered a verse about it once to the Kiwanians. There's nothing can defeat us, whatever life may bring, because we can go and eat us some chicken a la king. Oh, I'd rather be a Kiwanian than in any other club. Actually, chicken a la king in those days was a multi-regional, multi-class dish. In the east, on the northern shore of Long Island, in fancy parties, old money Eastern rich people would eat chicken a la king. I can see some of you here. How does he know what old money rich people are? Well, I knew some of them because my father grew up in St. Joe, Missouri, had read a book called Stover at Yale. He decided that Great Eastern University was just the place for me. So I knew some of these people. They were thick on the ground in those times in Yale. A lot of them had three last names. I had a roommate named Thatcher Baxter Hatcher. They didn't call themselves all those names in normal discourse, of course. They all had tiny little one-syllable nicknames. He was called Tush. Tush Hatcher. He took me to some of these parties, debutante parties, on the northern shore of Long Island. At one point in the evening, they served supper. This was very late, about midnight, about 1 in the morning, a full 8 hours after people at home had had supper. In Kansas City, we try to get most everybody fed before dark. Here it is, about midnight or 1 in the morning, and it's supper time on the north shore of Long Island under a tent. Enormously snotty-looking waiters come out bearing huge silver bowls. In the silver bowls, chicken a la king. Not very good chicken a la king. Not nearly as good as Kiwanis Club chicken a la king. Because in general, the people in those clubs don't eat very well. Any of you have aspirations to joining old money Eastern society, I have to warn you, the food is awful. In fact, it was then that I figured out that the tastiness of food in American clubs is in inverse proportion to the exclusivity of the club. It's a very valuable thing to know. I mean, if somebody at the office invites you to a wedding, you don't quite know where you are, you can't quite place the club you're in on the social scale, and the hors d'oeuvres come around, and if it's a piece of Velveeta cheese on a slice of day-old Wonder Bread with the crust cut off, you are in a very classy joint. I always wondered why those people wanted to eat food that tastes like balsa wood. And then I realized that they associate spices and garlic and schmaltz with the sort of people they're trying to keep out of the club. At any rate, around midnight, here come these waiters, silver bowls full of chicken a la king. There's a theory, in fact, that chicken a la king is the reason that people from that background sometimes talk without opening their mouth. According to that theory, the glop the chicken a la king floats around in, particularly if it's allowed to have a chemical reaction with silver, particularly if the silver has been in the family for more than three generations, tends to cause the teeth to bond together. I don't know if that's true because they still talk that way and there is no chicken a la king anywhere. And I still wonder where it went, particularly when I go home to the Midwest and I drive across those great fields of soybeans and I see those silos off on the horizon, and then I think, what do we really know about what's in those silos? Could be that a lot of things that seemed to be all over and then suddenly disappeared, grabbed by the government, stuck in those storage silos. Maybe silos full of Nehru jackets out there. Way out there in South Dakota somewhere, dozens of silos full of chicken a la king. When people talk about somebody being very Midwestern, they usually mean he's friendly, straightforward, not neurotic. I don't know why Midwesterners are so much less neurotic than the people I met in New York. It may have something to do with the fact that Freud never really caught on in the Midwest. We don't talk much about what happened to people when they were little bitty babies. About as far as we'll go on analyzing behavior is the old Midwestern quote, everybody's who he was in high school. We don't go beyond that. You don't know these things about your own region until you leave. Until I lived in the South for a while, I didn't realize that Midwesterners don't talk much about their ancestors. I didn't meet one white person in the South who didn't have an ancestor who was a colonel in the Confederate Army, at least a major. Finally figured out that's why they lost the war. They didn't have any enlisted men in that army. And of course, New Englanders, I realized after being in the Midwest, where people are pretty open and friendly, are quite reserved. It's hard to keep in mind. You lose track of it, but I was reminded again several years ago when I published a book with a New England company. I couldn't figure out why the book had come out so quietly. It kind of came out at night. I thought of it as a commando with its face blackened so that the moon wouldn't shine on it, slipping into one of those black rubber rafts onto the tide. They even had a disguise for it. They had a book jacket that made it look as if it might be the biography of the founder of the Wilkes-Barre school system or something like that. I finally realized why they were doing this so quietly, because they were afraid that otherwise strangers might buy the book. And of course, I had never met in the Midwest anybody like Thatcher Baxter Hatcher, Tush Hatcher, and his friends Horton, Houghton, Houghton, Mutt Houghton. And a lot of things that they talked about were absolutely foreign to me. It really happened the first week I was in college. Thatcher Baxter Hatcher said that after the war, his family no longer dressed for dinner. I thought it meant they came down in their undershirts. I said, Tush, my mom wouldn't allow that. There were a lot of kind of things that they knew automatically about their culture I had never heard of. When I got to Yale, I remember I had never heard of either Dostoevsky or Greenwich. Greenwich, Connecticut, as some of you may know, is the kind of prototypical home of the prosperous WASPs in the East. I still don't know much about Dostoevsky, as a matter of fact. I'm learning more all the time about Greenwich. It was in the news at the beginning of the first term of the Reagan administration, what I think historians are now referring to as Voodoo One. There was a lawyer from Greenwich who was appointed chairman of the Federal Synthetic Fuels Corporation. He told the committee that was sitting in on his confirmation that he didn't think he could accept the job because the salary, $150,000 a year, was so far below a living wage that if he accepted, he might have to move out of Greenwich. This, the Reagan administration was using a phrase at the time, truly needy. Of course, I thought, what will happen? Maybe everybody who makes less than $150,000 a year will have to move out of Greenwich. I could imagine them on expulsion day loading up their station wagons, packing in their little Shetland sweaters and circle pins, heading west in caravan like a preppy Grapes of Wrath. Of course, they'd camp outside of towns in the West, make camp outside of Grosse Pointe and Lake Forest and Beverly Hills. People would call them greenies. Nobody liked them. They wouldn't go into town because townspeople hated them because they'd undercut them. They had people there who would work for $135,000 a year. So they never went into town unless they needed something absolutely desperately, if they ran out of coffee filters or something. They'd make their pathetic little greeny suppers on the tailgates of their station wagons. Cold breast of chicken, a little white wine. Of course, my father thought it was a good idea to meet people like that. He thought that someday those people are going to be in charge of things in this country. It's nice to meet them. After I went to my 25th reunion, I got back and somebody said, was it depressing meeting a lot of people who thought they were going to be in charge of things and aren't? I said, no, what was depressing was meeting people who are in charge of things. Because I know those people. And it scares the hell out of me. I think that's what happens to everybody around 25th reunion age, when people start to act a little funny, leave the job at the bank and run off with a teenage mushroom gatherer and that sort of thing. People say it's hormones acting up. It's not hormones. What happens is this guy sees people he knows being put in charge of things and it frightens him. A year or so ago, I read in the New York Times, so I'm changing the names here, that the trade relation talk with Japan was being put in the hands of a deputy undersecretary of state named L. Dalton Durfee. Well, I guess a lot of people said, great, everything ought to be all right now, deputy undersecretary of state. I looked at it and I said, my God, it's dumb Dalton Durfee. It's the fourth dumbest guy in my class. This is a guy whose most penetrating display of intellectual curiosity was when he asked the geology teacher if AM meant morning or afternoon. Figure the Japanese will have California by Christmas. See, everybody knows people like that. You read in the paper that somebody's just been put in charge of the surgical unit at the most important hospital in town. You know that guy was held back in third grade for klutziness. Even the yellow pages can scare you at my age. Attorneys. In Akron, Ralph W. Moschler, Esquire. It's Blinko Moschler. the dumbest guy in my class. Blinko Moschler could stand in the intellectual shadow cast by Dalt Durfee and never see the sun. If he's so dumb, you say, how did he get through law school? If it's so hard to get through law school, how come there's so many lawyers? On the other hand, sometimes it's kind of comforting when you're being lectured rather condescendingly by a doctor. It's nice to keep in mind that 50% of the doctors in this country finished in the lower half of their medical school class. I think the most difficult transition was not from the Midwest to New England, but from the Midwest to New York. That is very hard. Those of us who are out-of-towners in New York, I've been an out-of-towner there for 25, 30 years, are often lost. I don't mean we're lost in the culture, I mean we're lost. Often lost on the subways. New York, until a few years ago, was the only city with a subway that had all of the subway maps inside the subway cars. You had to get on the train, decipher the map, assuming you were a graduate of the Royal Institute of Cartography, to find out you were on the wrong train. Get off at the next stop. It was always Queens Plaza. I mean, we're lost also in the culture, too. People from the Midwest don't expect every single person on the street to think of himself as a comedian. In New York, this actually happened to me. I hesitate to say it because it sounds like a lounge comic line. It actually happened to me on 6th Avenue. A panhandler came up to me and said, "Can you spare a little change? I'd like to buy some junk bonds." Also, people are very contentious in New York. There's no question about that, because it's crowded. Midwesterners aren't used to that. In the Midwest, you can walk up to a man who's selling newspapers and ask him for change for a quarter. He's not going to call you a fascist for doing that. But it's a contentious place, and everybody's, because there's so many people and it's so crowded, everybody's afraid of losing out. I think the story that illustrates this best is a true story that was in all the tabloids last year after Mayor Koch was ill. He was in the hospital for a couple of days and got back to Gracie Mansion, and the guard at the gate called up and said, "There's a woman down here to see you, and she says she's Mother Teresa." This is true. Well, as it happened, the mayor knew that Mother Teresa was in New York starting up a hospice for people with AIDS. So he said, "It probably is Mother Teresa. Show her up." And she came up, and it was. And she said that she was happy to see that he was looking well and that she had said some special prayers for him. And the mayor said, "Mother Teresa, may I take this occasion to say how proud and happy we are that you're in our town and grateful for your work. If there's anything I can do, please let me know." And Mother Teresa said, "Well, in fact, there is just one thing. It would be a lot easier if we had one or two reserve parking spots in front of the hospice." This is true. Mother Teresa, perhaps a saint, is hustling the mayor for a parking spot. You've got to say it's a tough town. Also, it's much more political than the Midwest. Midwest people don't talk about politics much. When they talk about politics, they're talking about Democrats or Republicans, the kind of kid Joe for being a Republican. He's a Republican because his grandfather is a Republican. In New York, politics are politics. And when I first got there, you could even tell from the headlines on the tabloids about their politics. The New York Post then was predictably liberal, what the New York Daily News would have called knee-jerk bleeding heart. And I worked once on a parody of the papers during a newspaper strike, and the headline I wanted to use on the New York Post was, "Cold snap hits our town. Jews, Negroes suffer most." I didn't realize quite how political all of this was, how intense they were politically, of course, until I started writing this column for The Nation. And I think I might have talked about this last time I was here because it was fresh in my mind. The Nation is, those of you who don't know the sort of magazine The Nation is, I was asked in Boston by a reporter to describe The Nation, and I thought for a while and I said, "Pinko." And he said, "Well, surely you have more to say about it than that." And I said, I would say it's a pinko magazine printed on very cheap paper. It's the sort of magazine that if you have an article and then you make a Xerox copy of your article, the copy is a lot better than the original. This, of course, is all have to do with problems with money. I've written about this a number of times. It's true that my first offer when I asked the editor of The Nation, the wily and parsimonious Victor S. Novasky, what he was intending to pay me for each column, he said something in the high two figures. Well, that didn't end there. I turned all of this over to my high-powered New York literary agent, Robert Slowly Lesher. I said, "Play hardball, Slowly." So Slowly got him up to 100. And about the first month I was at The Nation, Novasky came to me and said, "What about these quotes?" I said, "What quotes?" He said, "Did John Foster Dulles really say, 'You can't fool all of the people all of the time, but you might as well give it your best shot'?" I said, "Victor, at these rates, you can't expect real quotes." Somebody today asked me if I was still having trouble with the person around The Nation office I used to refer to as Harold the Committed. I don't write about him much anymore because now that the column is syndicated, I don't like to make fun of just one guy in New York. But he's pretty much the same. He is the guy, for those of you who don't know about him, who is a little worried about my lack of political intensity. He is afraid that I may have let the agony of the Scottsboro boys slip from my mind. And is constantly asking me if I would like to see the world as we know it destroyed in a nuclear holocaust, even though I've assured him any number of times that I would not like to see them. I mean, I have my bad days, but my girls are almost grown now, but the answer to the question about whether he still harps on whether or not we are raising them with sufficient political content is yes. As you may remember, he wanted my older daughter to go to the Halloween parade we have in Greenwich Village, where I live, as Emma Goldman. She went as a box of M&Ms that year. He wanted my younger daughter to go as the dangers posed to our society by the military-industrial complex. I said, "Harold, we don't have anybody at home who can sew that well." She went as a chocolate chip ice cream cone with chocolate sprinkles. I think one of the reasons Harold the Committed thinks we're so odd is that we think of ourselves, it goes back to the whole business of where you come from, what your region is. We think of ourselves as running a kind of a regular Midwestern family in Greenwich Village, and which happens to be a neighborhood where a lot of people go around as chocolate chip ice cream cones all year long. I don't mean that we have exactly policies about raising children. Sometimes somebody who's just had a baby asks me if I have any child-raising advice, and I always say, try to get one that doesn't spit up. Otherwise, you're on your own in this thing. We do have one friend in the village who thought that she needed at least some rules. She's a widow, and she was raising a boy by herself, working. He's a fine boy. He's about 17 now, Nick, but he was a handful when he was a little boy. And his mother decided it would be a good idea to put some rules up on the refrigerator door so Nick would know where he stood, although Nick, I think, knew where he stood, which was usually on the dining room table in those days. Nick and I talk about it a lot. The only rule we can remember is rule number 6, enough's enough. By coincidence, just after Nick and I had a discussion about this, there was a bank robbery, which was reported in the New York Times in Brooklyn. Kind of an amateur job. The guy got away with a couple of grand. And the assistant branch manager, a woman in her middle years, chased him out the door, chased him down the street, tackled him, and was about to do him serious physical damage when he was rescued by a couple of passing sanitation men and held for the police. Well, the reporter was astounded at this, and he said, "Madam, how can you explain your behavior?" She said, "Well, the bank was robbed once last year, and enough's enough." Of course, the robber had no way of knowing she felt that way. Nick and I decided they should have had a little sign, right, where they have their policy on cashing third-party checks or something. Okay. Warning, at this branch, rule number 6, strictly enforced. It's a good rule in general, I think. Actually, during the last political campaign for president, about the time that George Bush got to the flag factory, our family, of course, is considered unusual in Greenwich Village because my wife and I have been married for a long time. But that would be true in Kansas City, too. That's not a regional difference. All around the country now, long-term marriage is, in the public mind, I think, inextricably entwined with the music of Lawrence Welk. It's particularly odd in the village, though. We keep thinking we'll be put on the Gray Line tour as the last nuclear family. People will come and watch us at dinner, watch our little domestic dramas, which, like most American families in any region, are basically about the manipulation of the father. Kind of Ozzie and Harriet, really. This happens in our house. We actually had a scale tampering incident at our house. My wife was involved. It's hard for me to say. It's not easy for anybody publicly to say that his wife, mother of his children, niece of his Uncle Benny, was involved in a scale tampering incident, but this happened in our house. I got on the scale one day and said, "This scale has been tampered with." I looked around for some way to make a scientific test, and the only thing I could find that had weight printed on it was a 10-pound bag of kitty litter. I weighed the kitty litter, The scale said it weighed 13 and a half pounds. I confronted my wife with this evidence. It's absolutely true. These are real quotes. My wife, who has a master's degree, said, "It evens out at the higher weights." So now when she says, "Have you weighed yourself lately?" I say, "No, but I weigh the kitty litter daily." People from the Midwest often say, "Well, the cultural opportunities must be great living in New York." But again, it's kind of like the Midwest. We go to a lot of school plays. Here's what my wife believes about school plays. She thinks that if you have a child in a school play and you don't go to every performance, including the Thursday matinee for the fourth graders, the county comes and takes the child. So in a lot of ways, a family in New York is like a family in Kansas City. Well, there was a time around the time that the Carter administration was floating a lot of mottos when I got it in my head that families would have mottos someday. And I knew our neighbors would be thinking of a lot of flashy, sophisticated New York mottos. Goldbergs down the street would put on their mailbox, "The Goldbergs' best mixed marriage yet." And the Bartletts around the corner would have on their stationery, "The Bartletts, a triumph in group therapy." We tried to think of a motto, and we eventually went back to the same motto my family had had in Kansas City: "Zip up your jacket." My main opportunity to study these regional differences came in the 15 years I spent traveling around the country, doing a piece for The New Yorker every 3 weeks somewhere. There was someone from the Associated Press, Jules Lowe, doing a similar sort of series, and Jules and I formed an organization, the American Association of American Correspondents Covering America, or to use our acronym, GLINGPAC. We just kind of like the sound of GLINGPAC. We were the only two members, Jules and I. Because we had some fairly strict requirements. We had one rule for membership: you can't quote de Tocqueville. Jules and I lived in O'Hare Airport in Chicago around that time. We thought of it as HQ GLINGPAC. It's the busiest airport in the United States, maybe. Actually, there's been a challenge from Atlanta now. I used to live in Atlanta. They're tremendously interested in bragging about Atlanta. Tremendous boosterism in Atlanta. When I lived there, particularly if you walk by what's thought of as kind of the center of Atlanta, the financial district, Five Points, the person with you would always say exactly the same thing in the same words: "Did you know that Atlanta is the fourth target on the Kremlin's map of nuclear destruction?" I don't know what wacko civil defense general came in and told them that, but it really impressed them. Very hard to think of a response to a brag like that. Finally, trying to be a good guest, rather nervously one day, I said, "I think it ought to be first." But Chicago would claim in the argument with Atlanta that more planes land and take off in Chicago than at any other airport. What they don't tell you, a lot more land than take off. So the GLINGPAC people spent an awful lot of time in O'Hare and talking to various people who I got to think of as kind of my community, traveling salesmen, regional auditors. people crossing state lines to advocate the overthrow of the government. Traveling people. I don't mean that I didn't occasionally talk to civilians. Obviously, one of the big changes in American society since the war has been the casual access to air travel. That was brought home to me a few years ago when I was told that the largest ski club in the United States is in Dallas, not a mountainous region. I actually knew a story about the Dallas Ski Club because I had spent some time once in the Taos Ski Valley in the summer in New Mexico. A lot of Texans go to ski in New Mexico. And New Mexico people like to tell stories about them and their accents and their spending habits. And I was told that the Dallas Ski Club arrived all 7 or 8 million strong. I don't know how many there actually are in the Dallas Ski Club, but it was rather late in the afternoon and it was pretty much dead winter. The people in the ski valley said, "Darkness falls very quickly here. Maybe you better wait till tomorrow morning." I said, "No, they want to get out on the slopes." So they all went out there on the mountain, and just as soon as they had, God turned off the lights. It was pitch black. The fellow who told me the story was one of the people who went on the ski patrol to try to gather them up. I said it was terrifying. It was absolute darkness. People alone everywhere, standing all over the mountain. Absolute silence. And all you could hear was, "Hep, hep." But mostly in O'Hare, I would talk to other traveling people, compare notes on motels and restaurants. When I first started traveling, of course, the restaurant we all feared, this was in the late 60s, was the one that I started calling La Maison de la Casa House. Continental cuisine. I did some research on this, and on a couple of books, and I finally decided where they got continental cuisine. There was some connection with the Continental Trailway Bus Company. Very fancy, these places. Menus entirely in French, except for one dish, of course, surf and turf. I've done years of research trying to figure what animal a surf and turf comes off of. Finally decided it was a tiny aquatic Hereford. The rest of the menu's in French, though, of course, and which is somewhat of a problem because the waiter doesn't speak French. Dwayne is monolingual. One time I saw a dish on the menu that said poulet au champignon suprême. I said to the waiter, "What do you think that is?" And he looked around to see if anybody was looking, and then he whispered, "Chicken a la king." I want to say, by the way, I want to clear up one regional misconception, and that is, I know you people who are out west think that Midwestern people are not very sophisticated, and you think that Midwestern people are intimidated in fancy restaurants, and particularly by wine and that sort of thing. Not true. I happen to be the one in a discussion recently in the Napa Valley on the similarity between some French and American wines who said that I thought Chateau Lafite Rothschild and Manischewitz Pink Catawba both tasted rather Jewish. Also, I'd like to explain, there's some misunderstanding about what happened in the fancy restaurant in Chicago with my high school buddy Charlie and the wine steward. This has been taken as a kind of Midwestern ignorance. It wasn't that at all. For those of you who don't know about the incident, Charlie was taking a bunch of business acquaintances for a big fancy dinner in Chicago. He ordered a 73 Bordeaux. The wine steward brought the wine, uncorked it, put the cork in front of Charlie, showed him the label, poured a little wine in his glass. Charlie ignored the wine and ate the cork. Now, a lot of people thought that was pure ignorance. It was not. Charlie's kind of a joker, and his plan was to chew on the cork for a while and look at the wine steward and say, "This is not a 73, but never mind." Or anyway. But Charlie's also a little ham, and when he realized that everybody in the restaurant was looking at him, apparently it hadn't occurred to Charlie that people would find this something to get their attention. When he saw that he was the center of attention, he couldn't resist chewing on the cork for a while, swallowing most of it, and then turning to the people in the restaurant and saying, "I'm not a doctor, but I play one on TV. And I know the value of fiber in your diet." I want to confess that I'm not the only person who has a two-region theory of this country, but all of the other people who have a two-region theory live in Washington, D.C., and they see only two regions. There are different two regions than I see. They see inside the Beltway and beyond the Beltway. And it's true that they think that the people beyond the Beltway, all of us here, really fail to understand some of the sophisticated issues that are perfectly understandable to people inside the Beltway. And it's true, it's kind of a mystery to all of us, Washington, although I think all of us kind of suspect it's a place where rule number 6 is not strictly enforced. But I've had to deal with it now that I write a column that touches on politics. I've learned some of their language, and it's simpler to understand when you know their language. "Too soon to tell" is one of their big phrases. It's one of those rare phrases that allows you to sound wise by saying you don't know. And I use that a lot. If I'm asked, "Do you think that the Reagan administration really will be able to reduce the deficit by having that man who's costumed as Catherine of Aragon stick pins in an effigy of the national debt?" I say, too soon to tell, I think. Or even if... even if one of my daughters says, "Daddy, how do you find the area of an isosceles triangle?" It's too soon to tell. This period of transition now that we're in is always an odd time for me, because at this point in any administration, I realize that I'm pretty well ready to see the people leave. I'm tired of them usually. I'm tired of their friends, their family, cats and dogs. And I want a new face usually. I remember when Nixon walked out to the helicopter. I was watching it on television. And I said, "Glad to see the back of him." No more Bebe Rebozo. No more Trish Nixon's chicken divan recipes. Pouring a couple of cans of chicken soup on some poor bird that's already a chicken. Then Carter came in and started talking about a national malaise at a time when I happened to feel just dandy. I said, "Maybe we were a little hard on old Bebe Rebozo." What I realized at that time was that every administration makes me nostalgic for the previous administration. Because I have to say this about the Reagans, they were great at not inflicting their family on us. Or on themselves, for that matter. I thought it was wonderful when Michael Deaver was described as being so close to the Reagans that he was like a son to them, something that had never been said of any of their own children. The one great story I was unable to follow up on was that it was said that Ronald Reagan Jr. was seen on Fifth Avenue waving and yelling, "Hiya, Dad," to a man who turned out to be Joel McRae. They weren't close. And I did think they were good sports, too, because right as soon as they got in, I said some unkind things about why Mrs. Reagan always smiled and never laughed, and whether or not the president thought Polaris was a denture cleanser. And then the USIA asked me if I wanted to go on a cultural exchange trip to South America. And I thought, isn't that nice of them? I mean, they're really forgive and forget sorts, really. And then I thought for a while, I realized cultural exchange, what would that mean to them? And I realized that they had confused me with Calvin Klein. Then, after a while, though, all these guys started stealing, as far as I could see. I mean, I came a time when one of the news magazines ran 3 or 4 pages of little mug shots of Reagan administration people who had been indicted or left under a cloud for some reason. Looked like one of those life insurance ad, leading salesman of the tri-state area. I started missing Burt Lance. I thought, oh, Bert was all right. It's kind of refreshing to find a banker who's not a nitpicker, I think. Now I know that Reagan's going to leave, and I'm going to say glad to see the back of him, and then I'm going to get nostalgic for him. Think about him just in a few months and remember all of the highlights. Remember the time at a reception for big city mayors in Washington when Samuel Pierce, the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, walked up to say hello to the president, and the president said, "Hello, Mr. Mayor, how are things in your city?" It was unreported what Samuel Pierce said in reply. Could have played it straight. "Excuse me, I'm Samuel Pierce, your very own Secretary of Housing and Urban Development." Or I like to think he may have been a little sarcastic, saying, "Oh, things in my city are fine, Mr. President. Most of the agencies are in the hands of the loonies by now, of course, and the president doesn't recognize his cabinet secretaries," but... Or maybe he just played along as if it was a little joke they had in the White House and said, "Oh, hello, Count." Of course, another high point was when Time magazine reported that the president often used as historical examples things that had actually been from Hollywood movies. And that he, at one time, in a meeting with a foreign leader, had pulled out the wrong 3x5-inch cards from his pocket and read the wrong speech. They didn't say who the foreign leader was. I like to think it was Mrs. Thatcher. President pulls out the cards and says, "My fellow Americans." Mrs. Thatcher smiles, thinking it's just one more joke she doesn't get. President says, "Americans are slow to anger, and they try not to get involved in the affairs of Europe, but when they do, they're brave and tough." I think particularly of a man who didn't want to get involved in the politics of Vichy France, a man who ran a bar in Casablanca. I'm going to miss them all, though, I think. Even George Shultz. Not many people are going to miss George Shultz. I'll miss him. I liked it when they were afraid that George Shultz was getting a reputation as being terribly dull. they leaked the news that he had a tiger tattooed on his backside. Their idea of Dash. Of course, made everybody wonder, well, what do the other cabinet secretaries have tattooed on their backsides? I thought maybe Cap Weinberger would have a tattoo of the Air Force's new $30 billion B-1B bomber, artfully rendered to give the impression that it's capable of flight. And now Bush is in, and I welcome him. But I know that one day he'll leave and I'll get nostalgic for him. Whose administration will it be? History follows. Perhaps Dan Quayle. Yeah. Think of the first summit. Two leaders of the most powerful nations in the history of the world, alone in the room, except for their interpreters. Their guy is Gorbachev. Our guy is Quayle. I'm trying to think reassuring thoughts at home. And I'm thinking, Churchill didn't have very good marks in school either. Second day, the word comes out that Quayle has left the meeting three times to call his dad back in Indiana. Gorbachev hasn't called his dad once. I'm trying to think of some more reassuring thoughts. Maybe Gorbachev will be disqualified for using anabolic steroids. Then the word comes, Quayle hadn't called his dad to ask for advice or to see if he had any influence with the international communist conspiracy. He was trying to explain why, after the first day, Gorbachev had not only Alaska, but controlling interest in the Indianapolis Star. I'm trying to think of more reassuring thoughts. All I can think of is HEP. HEP. Thank you. How do the questions work? I mean, people just stand up and in a rude way yell their questions. Are there any particularly profound questions? There's a gentleman here that I was going to call. Yes. I think I've forgotten those lyrics. You ain't bowling in my bowling league no more. Was that the? I wrote a novel once that had a guy named Dwayne Minnick, who was a filling station attendant who fancied himself a country music writer, and he wrote "I ain't bowling in your bowling league no more." He also wrote, I think, I'm just a loner while you look for the two-door hardtop of your dreams. And that song, these coveralls may be green, but I'm the bluest car mechanic you ever seen. I remember it ends with something like, you took me for a spare, it really isn't fair. I'm just not bowling in your bowling league no more. I don't think I sing. I did sing on stage the other day at a reading for something called East Harlem Tutorial Program that Garrison Keillor and I were, and some other people read, and he said he had written a cowboy song for the occasion and asked if I wanted to add a verse or two, which sort of, I leapt at it. I had actually promised my younger daughter that I would not sing cowboy songs on the street while we were together. But I hadn't said anything about a platform. Yes?
What are your top three amazing psychic predictions for 1989?
Amazing psychic predictions for 1989? I don't really know much what's going to happen. The only difference is that that I admit it. It's very embarrassing for a columnist not to know what's going to happen. Sometimes my wife says, "Well, why don't you write about how the trade deficit is going to affect interest rates, like the other columnists do?" I said, "Because I don't have the foggiest idea." It never stops them, she said. I haven't quite caught on to that yet. Give me a little time on that. Yes? I have any comments on William Bennett being named drug czar? No, why doesn't anybody ever tell me anything? I'm always the last to know. I didn't even know about that. Oh, he's a chain smoker. Oh, well, well, I mean, it seems right for this administration. I mean, they looked at Senator Tower and they said, well, he's a kind of a womanizing drunk who has a lot of connection with the defense industry. Yeah, he's sort of the guy we want, yeah. And I love the vision of John Tower as a womanizer anyway. I mean, there's hope for us all, really. Yes, sir. Oh, how's Garrison Keillor adjusting to New York? I think he's doing pretty well, and any time that it seems to be giving him trouble, he goes to Denmark for a while and learns to appreciate it. He refers to Denmark as the tiny kingdom, and he has a little trouble understanding Danish, and it's kind of a problem for him. And he said in the Times a few months ago on this subject that he realized that he had gone from being a success in America, to being a miserable person in a foreign country. He had done the reverse of the immigrant's dream. And they are, yes. Certainly not. Certainly not, although I have to admit that this morning I was asked on CBC, because every couple of weeks I do something on the Canadian Broadcasting Company, on a program they have, and they asked me what I had been doing in Seattle, because I didn't say, and also what I had been eating, and I have to admit that I did mention gooey ducks. The national dish of Seattle. I mean, Minneapolis thought it was in bad shape with lutefisk, but... And I admitted that we live in Nova Scotia in the summer, and I had decided that the monkfish was the ugliest creature that God had made. But then I saw a fully grown gooey duck. And the monkfish is better looking than John Tower.
Uh,
Yes. This is the only person who does what she's supposed to do.
Since the tragic death of Chairman Mao, I've been concerned that your fantasy life might have been depleted and wondered if you'd chosen another world leader to escort around New York's restaurants.
Oh, well, this is a reference to a fantasy I once had that Chairman Mao came to New York and I was asked to take him around. And we would only have one dish in each restaurant because he had all these people to preside over. He had a billion people in his responsibility. And so it's something I always wanted to do is go from one restaurant to the other. And but actually, when I wrote it, Chairman Mao was already dead. If you have a fantasy, it doesn't make any difference if the person is not. Because it's just a fantasy anyway. So if you can have a fantasy that you bring him back to life, and that's what I did. Yes, sir, in the back.
I liked your idea of changing the traditional Thanksgiving dinner to spaghetti carbonara. I was wondering how that's been received throughout America.
Well, I think, I don't know if bandwagon is the right word, but... I think there's a lot of support, particularly in the face of some of the thug tactics that the turkey lobby enforcers have been using. I think they're very impressed with my arguments, and of course, to the people who say, how can you eat anything for Thanksgiving other than what our ancestors ate? I mean, I always say, as it happens, one of the things I give thanks for in Thanksgiving is that those people were not my ancestors. I mean, these were people who spent most of their time in England making sure that everybody observed the Sabbath and cooking food with no flavor and came to this country for freedom to nag, as far as I can see. I thought Jay Leno had a great line I guess it was around Thanksgiving, about the Puritans. He said, how can you take seriously people who wear their belt buckles on their hats? I absolutely agree. Oh, there's somebody upstairs. Yes, ma'am.
Yes, I've seen you on quite a few talk shows, and I always get so frustrated because they never let you talk. Couldn't you come out and give something like you've done tonight, a short thing? Can't you talk them into that? Because they just chop you up, and you're really not, your great qualities don't come out. And after seeing you tonight, it's just fantastic to actually hear you, keep going, but they always chop you up. So, it's just a suggestion.
Who is this lady, and how did she get in here?
Call me up.
Thank you. Are there any friendlier questions than that? Yes. Thank God, somebody.
Do you have family cats, and if not, why?
Well, look, I already have the quail defenders after me. I already have the fruitcake defenders after me, sending me hate mail, threatening to send me a fruitcake. All I need is the cat people after me. We have two cats. I don't want to use the word kick exactly. I don't think I can talk about the cats and keep my temper here. And it's a church. We have two cats. You can't tell them apart, as a matter of fact. All the cat people said, oh, you will know them immediately and their personality. No, can't tell them apart. the other thing the cat people say is, oh, he'll love them. The people who say they don't like, they're the ones who, no. The cat people are wrong in my case. Well, I don't want to start with the cat people. Does anybody else have a question about human beings? Yes.
Right.
Well, this is a question about stopping writing about food. I actually kind of did stop writing about food in 1982 when I, because I was writing, I used food as kind of a comic relief when I was doing pieces every 3 weeks, and the people, the food people, kind of eventually drove me around the bend, and I couldn't stand it any longer. And also, I didn't need any more comic relief because I was not doing those pieces anymore. I always say that I make the exception of a piece that requires my presence in the Caribbean in February. And in fact, I'm going to have a book out in about a year that's about traveling and about our family traveling. I think it's going to be called Travels with Alice. And it'll have chapters in it that could have been in some of the food books, but I hope the concentration will be on traveling. But it'll have things in it like the time that Sarah, my younger daughter, and I checked out the fast food hamburgers on the Champs-Élysées for authenticity. Went to Burger King Maison du Wapere. That sort of thing. But no, I haven't really thought of another subject. I guess I write more about politics now in the column than I used to.
Have you thought about doing some investigative
reporting
in fundamentalist religion?
No. I have not. Yes? Right. Well, I believe they named an airport in Tulsa after him. No, Oklahoma City, their Will Rogers World Airport. And they also have the Wiley Post Airport in Oklahoma City, the General Aviation Airport. It's the only place I know where both airports are named after people killed in airplane crashes. Well, yes. No, I don't think. I don't really usually have much chance to eat in Portland. And this time I had just been in Seattle, so I had some gooey ducks to go. And I brought them with me. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Literary Arts, The Archive Project. That was Calvin Trillin, and this was his talk from 1989. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers over the first 30 years of literary arts in Portland. We have lots of other talks on our website. Listen to them all at literary-arts.org. The Archive Project is a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting, produced by Spencer Raymond. I'm Andrew Proctor. Thanks for joining us.